Do you watch a lot of podcasts or listen to a lot of podcasts?
I do listen to a lot of podcasts. Yeah, I do. Quite a bit, actually. Mostly financial, real estate, some political, but mostly.
Oh,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, it seems to be my main source of information these days, you know?
Oh, yeah, me too. Yeah, and so I've been like debating with this. It's like, do I start out, like some of them will do like a formal introduction to like, you know, the guests, and then others will just like Joe Rogan just is like mid conversation and just cuts in. I'm like, I kind of like that, you know? So
right.
Figured it could be either way. So we'll figure that out. But
yeah, well, his is interesting though, because this is long format. So he'll be in there 2-3 hours with his guest and, you know, face to face generally. And, you know, he takes out, you know, the fluff, you might say, and just goes for the meat. And so you get it, you know, if he's doing that. And, you know, what's he done? 2,000 podcasts now? I mean, it's a huge number.
Yeah.
Enormous number.
Yeah. It's a commitment. It's like he's like every day, basically, right?
And someone's
in the studio with him for that many hours. It's nuts.
Yeah. No, it's impressive. So. I mean, the guy's brain is just expanding, you know, exponentially. It's incredible how smart the guy is now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's so cool. Let's jump into this thing. I mean, obviously, so the purpose of this podcast, we're calling podcast, it's really just, I think I told you, is to tell the history of death care kind of through the eyes of the icons that created it. Okay. And you're like the father of funeral home websites. So I think your story is super interesting, and it's like goes back further than anyone in funeral home technology that I'm aware of. So I think that'll be really awesome. But to kind of break the ice for a first question before we get into your history, what's a fast food restaurant you like that you're embarrassed to admit?
Well, I'm pretty proud to say I like In-N-Out Burgers. I mean, everybody loves that. So, you know, that's the easy one. You know, nobody can, you know, contest that one. I guess McDonald's, you know, it's just like, you know, I got to go get a fish sandwich sometimes on Fridays at McDonald's and got to get a quarter pounder. Not really a Big Mac fan, but McDonald's, you know, we've got 5 kids and they love McDonald's. So, you know, we go there. I don't go there very often, but, you know, more often than I should, I guess.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, I always tell people when they're like, McDonald's is gross. I'm like, it is gross, but it's chemically engineered to taste delicious.
Exactly.
Yeah, I get that one. Well, yeah, man, just if you wouldn't mind, just start off like where are you from, like from the beginning.
Yeah. And okay. Yeah, happy to do that. You know, I call myself a Midwesterner, but a lot of people get confused when they tell them that I was born and raised in Buffalo until high school years. They're like, wait a minute, Buffalo's New York. That's New England. That's not Midwest. I was like, well, that's Western New York is more Ohio and Michigan than it is New York City. So I was born and raised there. Big Polish family, 100 relatives. Most of them were in Buffalo at that time. Unfortunately, most are gone other places now, but had a great upbringing with tons of cousins my age and a lot of cousins around the country still from the family. So that's kind of a nice thing. Moved to Ohio during high school years to Youngstown, Ohio. Interesting place to be from in the 80s. It was great in the sense that football was, you know, king there, and the DeBartolo family owned the 49ers, San Francisco 49ers, and that's the decade that they're winning their championships. So kind of a fun thing there. And even back then, you know, if the 49ers had an East Coast swing, they would come to Youngstown, Ohio, and they'd practice there for the week. And so we'd get to go see the Niners practice and that type of thing. And I'm pretty sure they still do that to this day. And so it's kind of a interesting small town, lots of Italian history there. Some might even say some mob history. And so not too many people still stay there because the job situation is not the best, but there's Youngstowners all over the country and running them quite a bit. Went to college down in Memphis, Tennessee at University of Memphis. Went there as a computer engineer, aspiring computer engineer, for an education, and got about a year into it. And it was at that time in the early 80s was still very focused on the, the hard science engineering programming, meaning like electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, civil engineering. And so the computer engineering space was really in that hard, hard asset type of engineering rather than the soft asset or, you know, the intangible programming. And so after about a year, I got out of that space and decided to get into business finance. So I graduated with a business finance degree. While I was there, I was on the football team. So I played football there at University of Memphis. That was an interesting run in the sense that I blew out both my knees my sophomore and junior year. And so after blowing out both knees, I was like, tore ACL, MCLs, had to get ligament replacement. But after I did that, I was like, okay, I think I'm done with football. I better focus on education a little bit more. And so I did that. And but
what still position did you play?
I played safety. So I played safety. Awesome. And so I was one of the, you know, faster, harder hitting guys out there, you might say, and enjoyed that aspect of the game. And also the cerebral aspect of it. Okay, what player are they running? Where do I need to be? Where do we all need to be set? That type of thing. So, you know, a little bit like a conductor or general back there trying to get everybody in the right position. After college, I took a job with Hillenbrand Industries Forethought Group. My sister was working at Hillenbrand Industries at the time, and I was getting ready to graduate, and she said, hey, you should come up. There's this new company here called Forethought, and this is in probably 89. And so I went up for an interview and interviewed in Batesville with seven different people. It was a grueling interview process. It was all day, seven different people I had to meet with. So, you know, other than lunch, it was an all day affair, they're interviewing, but pretty impressive, corporate world at that time. Hillenbrand Industries, a Fortune 500 company. They own, of course, Batesville and Hill-Rom and Forethought, American Tourister luggage at the time, Medco high security locks at the time. It's a very impressive company, really small town. I don't know, maybe 5,000 people, but it swelled to about 10,000 during the day when people came in to work there. And so I took that job. That was my first job out of college. And I went there as a sales coordinator is what they called it. And I was working with the Western regional manager for the Forethought Group, the sales reps. He managed the sales reps. And so I worked with him. It was a really good indoctrination into funeral service in the sense that I would travel a couple weeks a month, going to state funeral director conventions, going into open territories while we're filling positions, meeting with funeral homes all around the country, Texas, Oklahoma, California, Utah, many places. And the week that I would be back in Batesville, they would have me run customer trips, which, you know, Batesville and Forethought are famous for in the industry. And so I'd spend, you know, the entire week out at Jawakata Farms and entertaining guests and going to the Batesville casket plant and giving tours or going to the Batesville Experience Center and listening to presentations and then going to Forethought and talking about Forethought pre-need insurance and other funding vehicles. And so within a year and a half's time, I just, you know, I met 1,000 funeral directors, either, you know, out at state conventions and such, or, you know, people coming in. There'd be usually about 20 people on a trip, but I had two trips a week. So that was 40 people right there. Time is probably 40 weeks. So I met, you know, just a tremendous amount of people in a very, very short period of time. As at the end of the year and a half or so, they asked me to become a sales representative, and they gave me two choices, Houston, Texas, or San Francisco, Bay Area. And I'd been to both, and I'd, you know, covered open areas in both at certain times. And I was like, okay, I want to move to Houston. I mean, you know, housing's pretty affordable, that type of thing. And I don't remember the exact decision that was made, but it was like, no, Turk, we need you to go out to California. And I was like, okay, you know, here I was 23, 24, something to that effect, probably 23. And I was like, all right, let's go. And so moved out to California, lived in San Jose, actually, not in San Francisco. San Francisco was kind of the northern edge of the territory I had to cover. And right away, yeah, again, I'd been in that territory already, so I knew a number of the top clients in the area, been to visit them. And, you know, right away, I saw that the pre-need at that point in the early 90s was somewhat new to the independent funeral director. They may have done some trust in the past, but they hadn't sold insurance. They weren't licensed, this and that. But, you know, besides the funding vehicle and the insurance planning process, you know, the real hurdle was the marketing aspect of things. where do we get people to talk to about pre-need? And, you know, and most funeral homes, funeral directors won't just bring that up in the course of conversation. If somebody comes to them, walks in, they'll definitely sit down with them, arrange a funeral, and then ask if they want to prepay it at that time. So that had been going on forever, but actually doing the outreach and communicating with people, on the other hand, was new to them. I mean, of course, SEI was doing some things with, with telemarketing, with some direct mail, that type of thing. But beyond that, the average funeral home wasn't doing much. And so with Forethought's marketing department, I started setting up direct mail campaigns, newspaper inserts, some television advertising, so on and so on. And so I really, shifted my focus to be almost exclusively marketing. Okay, how are we going to market to people to talk about the services that you provide? That's really what made me a success in the area. And, I was rookie of the year, first year out. The last year there, I was leading sales rep in the company, really got down to the marketing. And then the other piece of it, of course, is you can have marketing. I literally would have a funeral home that was in a smaller community, send out 3,000 mail pieces, and they'd get 200 leads back, which was, just an insane, return percentage. But nobody had ever sent them a mail before about, pre-planning. And so this is the first time I've ever seen something like that. There was all this pent up demand, you might say. And so I go in and I talk to the funeral director. I say, "Hey, Joe, how are those cards going? How are those conversations going?" He said, "Well, I haven't seen anybody yet." And I was like, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I got all these cards, but nobody's come in to see me." I was like, "Joe, did you call him?" And he's like, "No, I didn't call him. Why would I call him?" I was like, "Joe, they're asking you for the information. You got to call them." And so first year or two in that territory, I set up these marketing programs and such. But then there was this disconnect. It had all these leads literally sitting on their desk, and the clients wouldn't call them because that typically just wasn't their nature to be a salesperson. And so I'm like, "All right, wait a minute, I got to figure out another way around this." And I had already met this gentleman. His name was Mark Cornybrook, he was one of the four people that started Forethought. Actually, he was one of the corporate strategic directors at Hillenbrand Industries, and they put him on this project that, that became Forethought. Anyways, he had gone out and started his own business called Prequest and moved out to Corvallis, Oregon. And so I communicated with Mark. I'm like, "Hey, Mark, I need some help." I said, "You got all these leads, don't know what to do with them. Funeral director, I can't run them myself because I don't work at the funeral home, I'm not licensed, what have you. And, what do we do about this?" And he says, "Oh, it's just, send me those leads and we'll set the appointments for the funeral director." I was like, "What?" He's like, "Yeah, well, we've got a call center of 20 callers and you just send those to us and we'll set the appointments for the funeral director and then they can meet with them." And so that ended up being a real benefit to the funeral homes as well as to my business in terms of selling, funeral planning. And, so after about 6 to 9 months of that time, I'm like, "Hey, Mark, you're on to something here. Let's do more of this." And at that point in time, I went to work for him as director of sales at Prequest, moved up from San Jose to Corvallis, Oregon. First time I'd really spent any time in, the Pacific Northwest. California is beautiful, of course, but very crowded and lots of people there. Where you go to Oregon, and at that time in the early mid 90s, it was just kind of on its upswing, you might say. And so really beautiful place, great outdoor state. So moved up there and worked with Mark in Corvallis just for a couple of years. At the time, my wife was going to grad school in the University of Oregon. She was getting ready to graduate. Some things at the business level had changed for Mark. So I decided to move on from there. And this gets into how FuneralNet was founded. I was in the office one evening, and our network technician, administrator, whatever you want to call him, he was in the office. I said, "Hey, Jim, I'm about to take off. What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I'm just chatting." I'm like, "What do you mean you're chatting?" He's like, "Yeah, I'm chatting online, with these people." I'm like, "Well, let me see. What are you talking about?" So I went around to his screen and I'm looking. I'm like, "Hey, where's that person? What are they doing? What are they saying? Who is that person?" He's like, "Well, they're like in, I don't know where they were, Brazil, Thailand, I don't even know, but they were somewhere else in the world." And I was just amazed to see that this whole conversation thread was going on in real time. I'd never seen it before. So it was the first time I'd seen that. I know the AOL had some chat rooms, but I really didn't participate in that. And I forget the name of the program. It might've been AIM or something to that effect back in the mid-90s that Jim was using. I'm like, Jim, what is that? And he said, well, it's on the internet. It's just chat on the internet. And of course I'd heard about the internet since 92 when, you know, Al Gore mentioned about the information highway or something to that effect. But I didn't really kind of get it. I had heard some things about how, you know, people were going to have internet in their homes and that type of thing. George Gilder is a futurist technologist, and he used to write about it in Forbes magazine. And so I heard about it and heard about how AT&T was going to run cable into everybody's home and you'd have this internet connection. So I kind of heard about the infrastructure aspect about it, but it didn't strike me until then with Jim in that chat room, like, hey, people are making real connections here. And, you know, this internet thing is going to be more than just, you know, delivery of, you know, programming or movies or what have you into your home through the internet. And so at that point in time, I kind of put the wheels in motion and started, you know, investigating the internet, that type of thing. At the time, you know, a good friend of mine owned a funeral home there in Corvallis, Oregon, Jay McHenry. I was like, hey, Jay, have you heard of the internet? And he's like, no, I haven't heard of the internet. What is it? I was like, I'm going to come over and show it to you. So I, you know, I think I printed out some things and showed it to him. He's like, what am I supposed to do with this now? I was like, Jay, we can build a website for you. It's going to be on the internet. It's going to be on the World Wide Web, I think we called it at the time. And people can find your funeral home and they can look at your prices and they can learn about you and your family and the services you provide and that type of thing. He's like, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about, Turk, but, you know, all right, let's do it, you know, that type of thing. And so we built this prototype, and Jim and I built this prototype website for Jay McHenry in Corvallis, Oregon. So this would have been, you know, late 95, early 1996. And so once we got this built, probably February, March of 96, I showed it to him. We got it up on the internet, got him McHenryFuneralHome.com registered and that type of thing. We put it out there. And at the time, there may have been a couple other funeral home websites out there, but they were more sort of focused on, you know, hey, this is the kind of embalming I do, or this is our family history. It wasn't, they were not commercially focused, you know, entities or commercially focused, you know, websites. And so we put this website on the internet, and Jay called me like within 2 weeks. He said, hey, Turk. He said, we got this family that came into us. They printed out our pricing, you know, GPL that we put online. I think they had packaging and that's why they printed out. And they say brought this package in from this other town, Albany. And it's only about probably 15 miles away. He said, but there's a river there. The Willamette River bifurcates the two cities, two towns. And he's like, we never get anybody from Albany unless they got a connection here. And so I asked the family when they came in, like, why'd you choose us? He said, well, we saw your website, and so we printed out the pricing. Things seemed like what we wanted to do, so we came here. And Jay's like, we never get that. We've never had anything like that before. So it was in with almost instantaneously that he had some results from that just by having a website. And it wasn't that he planned online or anything like that. They literally walked in, and they asked him, well, like, how did you come to find out about us? And they pulled out their printout of the package and said, yeah, we want this package. And that's how it all came together. So it was at that point, I was like, all right, how do I register this as a business? How do I start a business here? How do we charge for this? You know, what is the structure we need to do long-term, that type of thing. And so it was April 1st of 1996 when we started the business. Called it FuneralNet right from the get-go. That was the name. You know, talked about networking. Obviously, that's what the internet was about then. Still is today, I guess. And so we called it FuneralNet right away. So what I did, obviously, I knew thousands of funeral directors around the country. I called some of our better clients that I had people that I had served before and, you know, with forethought and had a connection down in California with a funeral home called Doug and Sarah Mortuary, old multiple generation, pretty large mortuary, probably 1,000 calls or what have you. And I called my friend Dan. I said, hey, Dan, I'm going to meet down in San Francisco. Let's get together. I want to show you the internet. He said, Turk, I don't know what the internet is. I said, well, let me come down and show it to you. And remarkably, I had to actually get them online. So they weren't online yet. So I'm like, all right, I got a modem. We're going to install this modem to your computer. We're going to connect you to the internet, and I'm going to show you the internet. And that's what I had to do. I mean, of course, I had printouts of the McHenry Funeral Home website. And anyway, so same type of thing as Jay is like, I don't really understand it. Dan Duggan was like, yeah, Turk, I don't know. He said, if you want to build us a website, here's a check for the website. Go build us a website. And so we did that for them. And so we started April 1st. Our first client was April 21st, I believe, or 20th of that same month. So we're off and running. And so I was working on the sort of client services, sales side of things, and Jim was building these websites. And at that time, it was very difficult to build a website. Everything had to be hand-coded. I mean, from top to bottom of the page had to be hand-coded. And how you even put a picture online was a, you know, bit of a mystery to most people. And then, you know, if you had a form online, that was a very difficult thing to do. So it was all very, very new at that point. And I guess probably a point to make at this point in time is that, you know, I knew the internet was going to be a thing. I didn't realize how it was going to explode the way it did. So this is June of, you know, April of 96, you know, 97, 98. I mean, you couldn't pick up a newspaper, or you couldn't turn on the television without somebody talking about the internet. I mean, kind of like Bitcoin was 5 years ago, and like everybody talked about it, everybody wanted being on it, that type of thing. So I really didn't understand how fast it was going to grow, but it just absolutely exploded. And, you know, we picked up, I don't know how many clients that year. Probably in the first year, we probably did 36 websites, probably three a month, what have you. So it really wasn't a huge number. But, you know, they were in Ohio, they were in Kentucky, they were in Florida. There are different places all around the country.
And when you got like Doug and Sarah online, I'm just thinking through like that process. Like you connected a modem and you probably took their phone line down for a minute, right? When you dialed up into the internet, right? Wouldn't that have like made their phone line busy during that time? Is that how it worked back then?
Yeah, it was a process. And, you know, and really the first 20 clients or so, you know, we had to do that. We had to get them online. I mean, it was like the first step is like, hey, I'm coming. I got this modem. I'm going to install it. We're going to connect it to the internet. Yeah, you got to pay $20 a month to AT&T to do that. But then once you're there, then you're online. And, you know, it was like, well, I got AOL. I was like, well, if you got AOL, you can connect to it, but this is how you do it. And it was a bit of a process to do that. I was like, just use this AT&T thing. It'll be easier. I was like, how do I look at the internet? And I was like, all right, using Netscape at the time was the only browser. I mean, it was kind of an interesting setup, you might say. And I, you know, and looking at your business, I know you had to go through the same things when you were setting up, you know, broadcasting videos, the whole thing. So I'm sure you had to do a lot of that same thing. So early on, you know, we did the first year or so, we just built websites, you know, by hand, that type of thing. Probably would have been late 97, 1998, maybe 96 even. It was pretty early on. One of our clients up in Washington State said, hey, Turk, he said, let me go back a second. There was a guest book. So one of the things we use as a sort of communication mechanism, and most people didn't have emails yet, or if they did, it was just with AOL. But they had this thing called a guest book on the front page of a website. And most people just like, hey, laying on your site, love your site, whatever. Thanks for being here. You know, that was it. Well, the funeral director called me out of Washington State, David Rill of Rill Chapel across the sound from Seattle. He said, hey, Turk, he said, we're getting all kinds of people that are, you know, sending us condolence messages through this guest book. I said, can we put our death notices online? I was like, yeah, we can put death notices online. So I went back to Jim's like, Jim, this client wants to do this. How do we do that? He said, okay, well, we can, you know, set up their death notice or obituary, put a picture of them online, put the service times online, and then have a guest book for each family, for each obituary. And so that was the first time we published obituaries, was with this funeral home in Washington State. And that took off like wildfire. I mean, if we used to have tracking mechanism, how many people showed up on the website. And early on, it was like 100 people came to, you know, viewed your website this month, what have you. As soon as we put that on their website, it jumped up by a factor of 4 to 5. 400 or 500 people a month, whatever it might have been. I mean, instantaneous. I mean, it just like we just turned the switch and all of a sudden everything blew up. And so that became a standard pretty quick in our business. It's like everybody's going to publish obituaries, which makes me laugh in a way because, you know, a very prominent funeral director in the Mountain States, he's like, Turk, why do we need to do this? Why do we need to put this out there? And he probably fought me until 99, maybe even 2000. And I was like, just do it. I'm not going to say his name, but just, everybody knows who he is. But just do it. And finally, he did it. And I'll have to show him this afterwards. We'll laugh about it. Finally, he did it. It's like, Turk, he said, I don't know why I didn't do it. You should have told me. I was like, come on, man. I did tell you. And anyways, he started selling flowers for services. They started doing some pre-need stuff for services. I mean, it just took off for him. And it was just so funny that, you know, here's this very prominent funeral director. It's like, I don't understand why we got to do that. It just doesn't make sense. Is it impersonal, you know? And that type of thing. So I think he was coming at it from the right angle. It's like, hey, we don't want to give up that personal connection, but why do we need to publish obituaries? And at that point, we probably had a couple hundred funeral homes already publishing obituaries through our systems. And so it was kind of a funny thing. I don't remember exactly when we started offering flower sales through our websites, but that is just an added dimension to the obituaries, you know, people publishing obituaries. It just really is a convenience factor because people were calling them or emailing them, hey, I want to send flowers or what have you. And so, you know, some of the funeral homes that had relationships or owned a florist would actually start selling flowers back in the late 90s. And then a client of mine in New Hampshire, Buddy Fanuff from Fanuff Funeral Homes and Cremation Society in New Hampshire is like, hey, Turk, you think we could allow people to arrange to pay for their cremation online? I'm like, yeah, we can, no doubt about it. So this is probably 98. And we, you know, at that time, getting a payment system set up was a hassle. I mean, a real hassle. And you had to jump through all kinds of hoops. You had to provide all kinds of verification of who you are and who we were technically of setting this up. And I forget the name of the system that we used at that time, but they were the very first like payment processor to accept credit cards online at that point in time. Somehow they were tied in with Wells Fargo, but it was a separate company. Maybe they bought that company or just partnered with them. Anyway, so that was in 98 or early 99 that we started working with Buddy. And he started offering, you know, Cremation Society memberships, Cremation Society planning. And it was pretty early on that Buddy said, hey, you know, I don't want them to become a member online unless they're going to plan their cremation. And so it was a forced structure, you might say, to say, hey, if you want to be a member, you know, part of being a member is you have to arrange your cremation. And of course, at the end, they have to pay for it, too. And so Buddy did a great job with that. We worked with him a lot of hours, a lot of time to get that set up and, you know, set up that system for him. And used that for many, many years, 15 years, probably through us, and worked out very well. And, you know, I felt, you know, in a way, I feel bad for the funeral directors in the state of New Hampshire because they had no idea what was happening online. And, you know, thousands upon thousands of cremations were arranged through this website. And it was pretty amazing to see the volume of people that would go online to arrange a cremation. It really sort of changed funeral service in a way. I don't think it changed funeral service. People were already choosing cremation as their option, disposition option at that point. But the internet just sort of sped up the process, you might say. So we ended up doing that for, you know, dozens of clients around the country, setting up cremation arrangement websites. Some people would embrace it. You do have to support it for that to work. So what I mean by that is worked here with the Cremation Society of Illinois and with Jerry Sullivan, great guy, and good friend of Buddy's and that type of thing. But initially it was difficult on his end because the staff really didn't want to say, hey, you can go to our website and arrange your cremation online. So it's like, hey, let's just work with you. We'll set this appointment, whatever it might've been. And so there was a real sort of challenge to, you know, to get the entire organization to adopt this new way of doing business, you might say. And so that was a challenge and, you know, people worked through it and figured it out. And the people that embraced it, you know, their business exploded. You know, you go from zero to 100 in, you know, 6 months, a year's time. So kind of an interesting thing there. You know, carrying on from there, in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, the way that you build a website had changed. You didn't have to hand code everything anymore. There was some templating of websites, that type of thing. But it really wasn't until, I'd say, the mid 2000s, so 2005, 2006, where there were actually good platforms out there that could do, you know, a good job with websites. So the, you know, the world had changed quite a bit in 10 years in terms of the way that you build and maintain a website. And really our most successful clients were the ones that were engaged with their websites. And, you know, every funeral home in America has a memorial service or holiday memorial service, what have you. And the ones that were most successful with them were the ones that would say, hey, you know, that would advertise on their website that they had this memorial event coming up, sign up online, reserve online, whatever it might've been. And so those are the most successful companies, at least in our view, and looking at their traffic and understanding their traffic and what that looked like. You know, those are the ones that really did well with it. So I guess like any new technology, you have to embrace it. Somebody has to spearhead it. Somebody has to understand it. Sometimes it comes from the top. Sometimes it comes from the bottom with the newest employee in the, you know, in the organization, or the youngest employee, I should say. But, you know, it can't, you know, they would find success many ways through that direction. Somewhere along the way, in the early 2000s, maybe even late 90s, I don't know if it was Buddy or somebody else said, hey, he said, we need to get more pre-need leads out of our website. How do we do that? And so we talked about some mechanisms through the obituary, you know, guestbook signing, and, you know, the more enterprising funeral directors that already started communicating with those people that signed the guestbook and started sending out messaging, you know, marketing messages, that type of thing, that became a database of leads, obviously, because they're connected to a death. But then we put the survey online in a pop-up window. And this is early on when pop-up windows, were a thing. They're big now again, but this is early 2000s probably. And so we started, you know, doing these surveys. And if you've ever seen the pre-need survey and Precoa, you know, lived on this for many years in their direct mails process, you know, it would lead a person down this path. Simple questions like, you're male or female, you married or single, widowed, what have you. And next thing you know is like, have you thought about your, you know, what do you do if you die, you know, or your partner dies or something to that effect? Will your children be provided for? And it was a very well thought out process. And so about 10% or 15%, somewhere in that range, would actually say, yes, I want to know more about pre-planning. And then the funeral home or the pre-planning company would have that lead to follow up on. And so it was a successful tool in really helping the funeral home grow their business from the pre-need channel, along with the online arrangement process as well. So that was a big thing for a while, and then pop-up blockers started coming about, and all of a sudden the process started dropping, unfortunately, and the success of it started dropping, and so you had to find other mechanisms to get out there. To reach people with pre-need and how to work your leads and that type of thing. Beyond that, then, you know, mobile sites became a big thing, probably 2007, 2008, right about the advent of the Apple phone. And so we started building a separate website specifically for mobile and then for the computer. And so we were managing two websites for a while. And then technology caught up, and, you know, by 2010 or 12 or so, you know, the platforms all had the mechanism that would, you know, expand or contract based on the screen size and that type of thing. So that was a technological change. So that was kind of an interesting point. From there, we moved into Google advertising. Google conquered the world in 2010, early 2010s. And so we need, you know, clients are asking us, how does this Google AdWords thing work? How do we, you know, how do we make sure that we come at first in these searches and that type of thing? So we started providing those services through one of our employees, and that became a big thing. And, you know, people today, I mean, you know, you can't run a business today without, you know, Google AdWords and advertising Google. I mean, I forget what the numbers are because I haven't, you know, looked into it lately, but at one point, it was, you know, they had some 80 plus percent of all the searches that were going on the internet. It's probably more now. And you just have to be there, and you have to be there in a very good way that shows the, you know, the benefits of your company over others. And so, you know, it was a technical thing to set those, you know, those ad, you know, campaigns up back then, probably still is today to some degree. And so we, you know, we needed to do that for them when we set those up, and we provided quarterly reports and we managed the flow and all the other things that happened there. So that was another sort of advent, you might say, of a change, and, you know, that we needed to come up with. And then on top of that, the, you know, Facebook came around too, almost about the same time as mobile. And it's like, how do we advertise on social media? What do we do there? That type of thing. And of course, you know, businesses spawned up around there. And so we started, we actually had a partnership there with a company that did that. And, you know, and so we started doing that with hundreds of our clients, and, you know, and they started managing their social media to some degree. We didn't go full on as it would take today to have a proper social media channel for your business. It definitely takes more work than ever to do that properly. And now obviously a lot of it's video. The video became the killer app with YouTube. And so now you've got to do a lot of things with video as you had to for many years, or at least a decade now, and to really be successful in business. So, you know, those are many of the pieces that, you know, that took place to work with our clients. And I can't say anything, you know, besides that first website, you know, I can't say anything was, a fresh idea that came out of our minds. You know, it was really, okay, we're here to serve our clients, and what our clients need, they're going to let us know. And we're going to track and provide those results. And, you know, because of our size and, you know, building thousands of websites, we, you know, we're able to figure out, what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, through the process of research and analyzation, then we could tell what worked, and we could share that with the next funeral home that we're working with and with the industry, and, you know, during conferences and such where I spoke. It was a pretty exciting time, and really enjoyed the process. Sold my business right before 21 years of being in business. So I sold it February 2nd, I believe, of 2017. Sold it to Matt Frazier. Matt and I talked about things over the years, and he decided to get into the business a little bit heavier on the website of things at that point. And so it was a good run for me, you might say. Really had a lot of good relationships, a lot of great employees that we worked with and that type of thing. Took a couple years off after sold the business, but about 2 years into it, I was like, I'm way too young to retire. I need to go back in the game. So now I'm actually in commercial real estate. I actually sell seniors housing communities, retirement communities around the country, and mostly on the East Coast. So I do that now, and it's remarkably similar business to the funeral industry. A lot of independently owned companies out there. They're obviously serving seniors as well. They talk about their clients and their families, just like funeral directors talk about their clients and families. So it's kind of an interesting parallel. I don't do that full time. It's more of a part-time thing for me. So life's pretty good on this end. I miss going to conventions once in a while. I definitely miss time spending with our funeral home clients, number one, and number two, of these different groups that we were involved in. One of the best groups I was involved in was with Larry Beeson, who's a former Batesville guy that started a consulting group out of Denver, and he would go around the country, and we would benchmark various funeral homes. We benchmark various companies like Ritz-Carlton and other, you know, major organizations that, you know, in the country that are, you know, Walt Disney as an example. And those conferences were always enlightening for me from the standpoint of running our business, number one, but number two, seeing how, the funeral homes and cremation cemetery clients that we had would, you know, be attracted to those ideas and how they could implement those ideas. And so, that was a great time. And really, looking back, I think, you know, the success that I've had is all related to, being a partner with with the client. You know, we're not just here to sell them a casket or sell them some product. You know, we're here to partner with them to help them grow their business and help them be more successful. And, you know, that's one thing I can look back on and say, you know, that's really kind of, you know, what was the magic sauce, you might say, in our business and, you know, in my career, really, in funeral service. You know, I had those three jobs and it was always, you know, working with those people. And it was fantastic in the way that, you know, I worked at three companies and many times I had clients that have been, you know, clients of mine at three different companies, even though they were, you know, pre-need funding vehicle, pre-need marketing company, and then a website company. I guess they all fall into a marketing category, but it was nice to see that. And so that's kind of where that we are today and where I am today in the world. And really enjoyed the process of, you know, being in the funeral industry and being part of it for all those years.
Well, and honestly, I think the profession is going to be really excited to see your name show up on some social feeds and advertising here when we drop this episode, just because you have had such an impact for so many years and you're still well known. And those that are newer to the industry, this will be a great introduction for them to realize, like, you know, any of us in technology really have a debt to pay to you because of what you built, and really kind of you laid the foundation for all of us and what we did. A couple of things you said that kind of blew me away. The one, the first website you built had pricing on it. Cause here we are, yeah, like 30 years later and it's still a debate, yeah, of like, do we put pricing online? And, you know, they're most likely going to have to, cause the law is changing again.
Right.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and when you and I first met, it was probably 15 or more years ago at least.
Yeah,
and, one of the things I remember, getting to know you early on was just, I recognized immediately, like, your attention to detail with your clients is just, I remember you saying something about, like, you know, if we're building a website for a funeral home and that town is known for sycamore trees, you're not going to find like any oak trees on that website.
Yeah.
It's like in any of the designs, things like that, that's really cool. So what are some of like the, just the toughest things, the hardest things you had to deal with as an entrepreneur, like those days where you're like, we're probably going to die tomorrow. Like, how is this business going to survive? Like,
yeah,
those stories come to mind?
Yeah, there's a couple points. You know, probably during the boom, the internet boom in the late 90s, 2000, before the internet crash in 2001, which really wasn't a crash. It was just kind of a little road bump, you might say. The hardest thing was finding employees, technical employees. We would find them, we'd train them, we'd bring them up to speed. And then they'd leave for more money, for a better opportunity, long term, what have you. And I can't fault anybody for that. And these are all young kids. I mean, we hired some kids out of high school. We hired people out of college, what have you. And these are, you know, programmers, designers, project managers, what have you. And in the late 90s, early 2000, there was so much money in the industry from an internet standpoint, not funeral standpoint, internet standpoint. And we're in Portland, Oregon, which was a big tech center at that time between San Francisco and Seattle, of course. And, you know, our turnover, our attrition was so high on that technical front. I mean, that was so difficult and disruptive. It wasn't disruptive. It was just more work on myself and, you know, Jim Durbin, you know, my partner who started with me from the beginning and, you know, worked with me all the way to the point we sold it. So that was a challenge. That was difficult. You know, I'd probably say that was the most difficult time. Another difficult point was in 2001, 2002, Forethought in Batesville decided strategically that they were going to have a funeral services group. And it was run by Fred Rockwood. That was the president of Forethought, that became the president of Hillenbrand Industries, or CEO of Hillenbrand Industries. And they said, okay, Turk, we want to provide our clients with this tool so people can arrange, you know, funerals online. And it's like, okay, well, you know, we're doing it. You know, we can do that with you. And, you know, and we saw it as a great opportunity to grow. And unfortunately, when Fred was elevated from the funeral services group up to the CEO or president or CEO, whatever he went to at that time, they decided to shut the funeral services group down. And so the entire, you know, 6-9 months, whatever it was, that we were in consulting meetings and building this tool that could be used on all their clients' websites and everything, it just went away. It went like poof, like that, you know, overnight. And so for a smaller business like ours, we spent huge money on that. And it just turned off. I mean, just, you know, the, all the opportunity and that type of thing went away overnight. And that was difficult. We had, you know, we bootstrapped, Jim and I bootstrapped the business from day one, and we took on an investor at that point because of this relationship and that type of thing. His name was Els Purdy, you know, famous funeral director from the Pacific Northwest. He was a mentor of mine. You know, he became an investor in that point. And unfortunately, you know, that that business decision that we made to put a lot of eggs in our basket into this new planning program that they're building with us and with our direction and with our partnership and so on, just disappeared. And, you know, we lost a lot of money in that situation trying to scale up in anticipation of the business that would come. I mean, they had 3,000 customers at the time, probably. We had, I don't know how many hundreds, but, you know, much, you know, more fraction of what they were, obviously, in terms of customers. And so that was a very difficult point in time for us. And then, you know, then beyond that, I mean, yeah, I'm sure there was a day or two. It was like, all right, how am I making payroll today or what have you? But it was never a long period of a period of like, hey, we got to make payroll. What are we going to do on that front? So that wasn't, you know, a real issue most of the time. And then I guess, the only other thing that was challenging was probably in the late 2000s, that we had so many websites out there that were built on older technology or legacy platforms, you might say, that it was difficult to move them over to these new platforms, these newer styles of building websites. And because of the mobile thing, you know, hey, we got to move it over to, you know, these new websites because this is technology has changed and you got, you know, different screen sizes. You know, iPads obviously became a big thing around the same time and the iPhones. And so, you know, that was difficult just from a process standpoint, you know, how do we, you know, move people over these new platforms and that type of thing. And some people are like, no, I like my website. I don't want to change it. You know, who cares about what, you know, the mobile or whatever. And so, you know, that was, that took a lot of time and took a lot of effort. And looking back, it's like, in a way, you know, it is probably easier to start from scratch than it was to you move these legacy clients over. I mean, we did it over time, but that was definitely a challenge. And, you know, and that probably, you know, stunted our growth somewhat. And so, you know, I take that back. We grew really well during the GFC, the Great Financial Recession. We're growing 25-30% a year, whatever it was. So we were growing very well at the time. So it wasn't really a matter of that. It was just the work that we had to do to get these people over these new platforms to, you know, to keep up with the times. It's just a lot of effort on the back end of things. But in beneficial long term, because, you know, those platforms then could, you know, be around for 5-10 years, whatever it might be. But we still I still think about it. I'm sure we had a handful of websites that were such old platforms, like 1990s builds, and it was probably 2012 or 15 years old probably. And it was just like, oh my God, I just can't even look at that. It's like they're just missing so much. And, you know, and you couldn't get them to move for whatever reason it was. And some people we moved just because, and other people just like, no, they want their old website the way it is. And that's kind of because that it shows up well on the screen that they have. That's a 15-inch monitor. You know, that's, you know, who knows? And so that was definitely a challenge as well. And I guess those are challenges that we experienced. So.
What did the company look like in the heyday, like the peak, the most websites you were hosting at a time, maybe how many employees you had at that time?
We didn't grow our website number as fast as we grew our touch points, meaning we had mobile sites, we had websites, we had social media platforms, we had Google AdWords. And so our services business was growing faster than our website business at that point. So our revenues were growing faster than our clients were growing, which was fine. And that's where the business had gone to. And that's where, you know, we felt like we needed to be. You know, at the largest point when we sold the business, you know, it was the largest point, we had 28 employees. So it was still, you know, relatively small business, but it was a good size and it was enough to manage. The management, I always enjoy client contact and sales and that type of thing. And the management piece was, you know, never the piece that really got me excited. I mean, the people got me excited, but the management piece of having to hire new people and train them, you know, I could do it, obviously, and done it many times, but at the same time, that really wasn't my main, my main attribute, you might say, that that really got me going every morning. But you know, but the people we worked with, you know, some left and went to work with Facebook, others left and went to work with Microsoft, others started their own businesses and you know, within the funeral service space. And so a lot of people, you know, moved on and did other things. And, you know, that, that piece is actually, probably a, you know, one of my favorite legacies, is to see where people had gone and that type of thing. And, you know, and some people just weren't a good fit. And so, you know, I'd spend time with them and say, hey, you know, let's talk about what you want to do and let's who you want to be and that type of thing. And we had some tools that we used to do that. And so sometimes it's like, you know, and they come to their own conclusion. It's like, yeah, I need to go do this. And one fellow, you know, to this day, he's like, you know, hey, I've got this name. And we had this conversation. And he's like, I've got this name, but he was never my dad. My stepdad's my dad. And this guy changed his name because of a conversation. I mean, obviously, he'd been thinking for a while. He changed his name because we had this conversation about his life and who he wanted to be in life. He changed his name. Because of the impetus that I gave him, was like, hey, let's talk about this and what you really want to be. Is this where you want to go? And so I spent a lot of time on the personal level, you might say, with our employees, which I think was great. And again, personal connection is really what the world's about. And so we really, you know, had some really good things happen in that regard. And, you know, and we were very open to people, you know, working certain hours and living in certain places before, you know, remote work was a thing. You know, we're glad that we could do that for people. And, you know, it is what we did. And, you know, and I'm proud to say that, you know, that we were very flexible in that regard. And we allow people to, you know, do certain things that were kind of out of the norm and not so much today, but maybe we're just ahead of times. You know, but since the pandemic, obviously everything's changed in terms of where people work from now.
Yeah, you've been ahead of the game for a long time, seems like. And honestly, you were the first to do so many things in the industry. So we've already got a long list. But what were there any moments where you're just like, man, we did it. We made it. Like any moments along the way where you're like feeling, you know, really good and proud of what you'd built?
You know, one thing happened. We're at one of Larry Beeson's conferences. And, you know, we're fortunate enough that, you know, to help them bring this organization along. And so we're the only vendor in the room. Everybody else is funeral home owner, cemetery owner, cremation society owner, what have you. And we're at Disney. So I don't know how many participants were there, call it 50, maybe 100 different companies, what have you. And we're going through the Disney University. And this was when that Challenger, was it the Challenger space shuttle explosion?
Challenger's in the 80s.
It wasn't Challenger, the other one that took off from Florida and blew up. Anyways, it happened while we're there at Disney. And so everybody's kind of distraught and like, you know, what do we do? And that type of thing. And, you know, I got together with our team real quick and said, all right, what do we need to do? All right, let's get some memorials up on websites right away. Let's allow people to, you know, leave their thoughts and condolences, that type of thing. And we ended up sending all of those in a printed format and in a book to some organization. I forget the name of it. But in a way, that was a proud moment for me in the sense that we're with this group. We're trying to, like, what kind of response does the funeral industry have? And these are a lot of funeral industry leaders around the country. And that was a response that we could provide to the group in a very quick fashion and very, you know, timely fashion. To the group that was there as well. And we opened it up to everybody. You didn't have to be our client to get that to your website. We opened it up to everybody and that type of thing. And so, you know, that was a proud moment. It was like, okay, we can make a difference. We can have an impact here, not only for our clients in the funeral industry, but for other people just to express themselves. And it was a pretty poignant time for something like that to happen. We did the same thing with 9/11. You know, when that happened, it wasn't in a room with other funeral directors. And so it wasn't as memorable in that regard. But we, you know, 9/11 happened. We did the same type of thing. We put up a memorial and, you know, we sent that information out to people, a lot of people to, you know, I don't want to say grieve, but to at least express themselves. And so, that, you know, those are a couple, you know, interesting things that this new technology could provide that you didn't have before. And many funeral homes put together guest books and registers and that type of thing in their funeral homes, the same type of thing. It was just transferring the idea online. And so that's, you know, that's something that comes to mind. I guess another thing, you know, always being in the light of being a partner with our clients. So this Larry Beeson group, you know, we talked about vision, we talked about benchmarking over the organizations and that type of thing, but many of our clients had not really worked through the whole process of understanding how the cremation business was affecting their business. And so many of them were kind of struggling in the sense that their systems were set up in the old school thought of, hey, we're doing funerals. That's what we do. We, you know, get $5,000 per funeral. I'm not doing these $1,200 cremations or whatever it might be. And so we partnered with, we brought in Greystone Associates, at that time, introduced them to the people in the group. And, I don't know how many clients they have now, but they work with a lot of the bigger and better funeral homes around there, or at least they used to. And, you know, Scott and I met when I was starting my business. Scott, you know, the principal of the company, along with Frank Sessions, you know, he and I met out at Ron Hast. I don't even know Ron Hast. He was a publisher within the industry out in California. So this is back in 96. You know, Scott had been working with Consolidator, I think, at that time. I was just starting my business. And so we went to go see Ron. And Ron's like, hey, come over and let's have lunch. So we went to a restaurant, had lunch. He introduces me to Scott at that time. We become instant friends. And, you know, we're about the same age. And so we kind of hit it off right away. And so we're talking about what he does from a financial standpoint, you know, brilliant from an analyst, financial analyst standpoint. And so I was like, hey, you know, I'm part of this group. Maybe, you know, maybe we need to talk about this more or what have you. And it was probably years later, but I, you know, I say, hey, Scott, come into this group with Frank and let's talk about the process. And it really helped a lot of our clients on the financial side of things and really changed their businesses and, you know, made them successful on the financial side of things. They're always successful in serving families. That was never a question. Their hearts were always in the right place. But how they did that from a financial standpoint was a whole nother thing. And that system that Greystone, you know, put together with Frank Sessions and Scott Newton really became the, you know, the standard of how you run your businesses. And, you know, they're still out there doing the good work that they do today, I'm sure. And so that was impressive to see. And it all started with over lunch, you might say, with Ron Hast, again, an industry titan. Mm-hmm. So I guess when you say, hey, Turk, we're really glad for what you did, you know, I've got to point out that, you know, what I, you know, why I become and what I was is really based on, you know, the connections and people that I had met and had trained under the years. I mean, starting off at Batesville, you know, my regional manager was Jim Ward. He was the guy that taught me about sales and relationships, and he had grown up in Batesville, and you know, Jim was personal friends, his family was personal friends with Hillenbrands, and so, you know, Jim would, you know, during the winter months would go make soup with Dan Hillenbrand, who was the chairman of Hillenbrand Industries at the time. And he introduced me to Dan when I was there in Batesville, and, you know, the access to, you know, knowing the history of Batesville and Hillenbrand Industry and meeting Dan Hillenbrand, the, you know, the last remaining brother at that point in time of the founder. And, you know, that was impressive. And then, you know, from Els Purdy, who became an investor in our business for a while, you know, owned 50, 60 funeral homes in, you know, Pacific Northwest. Ron Hast, who was a publisher in Mortuary Management, that was the name of his magazine back in the day. And, you know, became a friend and, you know, could open any door in America, really, from a funeral home standpoint. Buddy Fanuff, you know, the Northeast, we worked together on a lot of things. Bill McQueen down at Anderson McQueen in Florida. John Horan, of course, in Denver. It just, you know, a lot of great funeral directors and, you know, people that I got to meet and spend time with because they were clients. And, you know, so, you know, everything that I've been able to do is really, you know, on the backs of them, you might say, and, you know, the things that they were able to teach me along the way and we were able to do together. And so I'm really appreciative of them and, you know, for the industry, you know, from that standpoint.
Yeah. I mean, you named off a pretty solid list of legends right there in death care. Do you ever see yourself like back in funeral service at all?
Yeah. You know, I haven't really thought about it much. You know, once I sold the business, I hadn't really thought about it much, to say the truth. I mean, again, I miss the people, you know, I miss being at the conventions and, you know, meeting with funeral directors one-on-one and talking with clients and talking about ideas. But you know, I really haven't, we've got five kids, you know, all of them are excelling in life and, you know, kind of in a different stage in my life that, you know, I don't feel feel the need to be back in the industry, but I do miss the people. I guess that's the main point. So,
well, you can come visit everybody in New Orleans at NFDA this fall if you'd like to. I'm sure everybody'd love to see you.
I spent many times at New Orleans, so I'd love to be there with y'all.
Yeah, it'll be good. So, well, thanks a ton, man. I mean, this has been awesome. Your story is so inspiring. And again, just as a technologist in the space, like, just a major debt of gratitude to what you built. In closing, though, can you tell us something about you that would surprise us?
Well, probably the most surprising thing that I can say, I mean, you're pretty much an open book. And so, you know, what you see is what you get with me. But, you know, probably the most surprising thing is in 2008 to 2010, I lived in Bangkok, Thailand with the family. Okay.
Oh, wow.
So if you got a moment, I can share the story how it all came together.
Yeah.
So I think I mentioned already that we had these legacy websites and we're trying to transition and what have you. So I have this challenge of this, you know, all these clients on this old platform, what have you. And through ICCFA, you know, I was on a committee or two with them and met this funeral director, mortician, cemetery owner from Guatemala, Fernando Aguilar. And so we started talking about fishing. I love to fish. He's like, oh, you got to come down to Guatemala. I got to go fishing with me. I'm like, okay, let's do that. And so I went down there, call it 2006, 2007, December. And so I flew down there, spent the night at a hotel, what have you. He's like, yeah, come out to my office. You know, let's get together. I introduced you to my son and then we'll go fishing or whatever. I was like, okay. And so I show up at his office and it's in this industrial park, call it like a warehouse, essentially, that had been refurbished into something else or renovated into something else. And so he owns an insurance company, pre-need insurance company. He owns a bank. He owns a cemetery, a couple of funeral homes, that type of thing. So I walk into this office and over on the left, there's tellers there. And these are bank tellers. And over on the right, these are insurance tellers. And in the middle, there's a receptionist, what have you. And I said, hi, I'm Michael. I'm here to see Senor Fernando. And she's like, oh, okay, right away, you know, he'll come out. And so he comes out and we, you know, we greet each other, what have you. And he's like, hey, come back. Let me show you around. You introduced my son, Andres, who's still in the business and, you know, at high levels at the ICCFA. And so we go back. And the first thing I notice, and again, this is like 2006, 2007, is there's a glass door there. He puts his thumb on this pad and the door slides open. And I'm like, he had biometrics back in 2017. So I'm like, what the hell is that? I've never seen that in America, first of all. And so that slides open. And then we go back in his office. He's showing me things. And there's this huge room of like 40 callers. And he's saying, yeah, our system's run on Oracle and it's Siebel's system, which is kind of a precursor to Salesforce, what have you. And I'm like, well, what are all these client service people doing? He's like, well, they're setting appointments. So I was like, what kind of appointments? Like pre-need appointments for your funeral home? He's like, well, they're setting up some of those, but they're setting up mostly, you know, collection appointments. I say, what do you mean? He says, well, we have 40 motorcycle drivers that go out and collect the cemetery payments or the insurance payments from people on a weekly basis because people here in Guatemala don't have checking accounts. And I'm like, oh, wow. You know, we don't do that in America. You know, I just take, you know, just assume everybody's got a checking account in the world. And, you know, and so you've got these drivers go out. And then we go upstairs to their data center, and Andres is working in there along with some other gentlemen at the time, and there's all brand new Dell servers in there, racks and racks upon of Dell servers, and, you know, elevated air conditioned floors, that type of thing. And I'm looking at this data center, and we're hosting our websites, or we had at one point until Google came around with their crowding their systems, and so I'm looking at this, and I'm like, wow, this is really amazing. It's like, I'm really impressed that you've got all this, you know, technology here. He's like, yeah, we kind of need it for all our businesses, what have you. I'm like, well, where are these fellows from? You know, what do they do? And he said, yeah, they're all Guatemalan and, you know, they're paid here and, you know, Guatemalan dollars. But they all have Siebel Systems, Oracle, Microsoft, Dell. They get all these certifications, that type of thing. I'm like, wow. I said, that's really interesting. And so it just kind of stuck in my head. And then we toured the funeral homes, the cemetery, beautiful locations, what have you, and went fishing, absolutely amazing fishing. And I got back from that trip and I talked with Jim, my partner and chief technology officer. I was like, hey, Jim, he's like, you should have seen this. It was incredible. And at the time, Jim was dating this Thai gal from Thailand, and he was going back and forth to Thailand. And he said to me at one point, he's like, hey, Turkey, so I think I'm going to open up an office in Thailand. I'm like, an office in Thailand? Well, it's like, dude, that's the other end of the world. What are you talking about? But after I got back from that trip from Guatemala, I was like, all right, let's go take a look at it. And so, you know, Jim said, I want to live there 6 months a year. I was like, well, okay. And again, being flexible, I was like, if you want to do that, let's go check it out. And so March of 2007, you know, I flew there with Jim and spent 3 weeks there and figured out how to set up a business there and rent an office and find a manager and all those types of things. And so we ended up opening an office there. And the staff that we had there was specifically there to do changes on websites. And so we used to get, you know, I don't know how many requests a day, 100 requests a day, what have you, to change this on our website, change that, add this, you know, put up this event item or what have you. And I didn't realize what it really meant. I just knew that, you know, we can open up an office there. The, you know, Jim wants to be there, so it'll work out. And almost immediately, I find that, you know, we get requests in the afternoon in Portland, Oregon, where we're headquartered, and we'd send them through the internet, through the system that we're using at the time. I forget the name of it. It's like, hey, do this request, you know, to the staff that's in Thailand. And then when you're done with it, send us the complete notice and we'll check it. So it would happen because we're 12 hours different from Chicago. And so what we'd send a clock, you know, at 5 o'clock here in Chicago or wherever, I say Chicago as I live right now, it'd be 5 o'clock in the morning there. So they would show up as our day was ending, do the work, and we'd show up at 8 o'clock the next morning and it was done. And so our responsiveness, you know, just exponentially got better, way better. So through that process, my wife's like, I told her about Thailand. It's an amazing place, beautiful people, great food, you know, just very spiritual as well. And she's like, well, let's go have an adventure. I'm like, what? And she's like, yeah, let's go have an adventure in Thailand. I was like, what do you mean? It's like, let's move the family there and let's put the kids in international school and that type of thing. So we ended up doing that for 2 years in Bangkok, Thailand. And I'd come back for conventions and go to the office 1 week a month, you know, 1 week a quarter, what have you. And it worked out. And again, kind of ahead of your time and, you know, being able to work from anywhere and that type of thing. And it was just a fabulous family adventure. We traveled to all the countries around Southeast Asia. My one son, you know, played in a baseball tournament down in Singapore with his baseball club. My other son played in soccer tournament in Hong Kong with his soccer club. You know, spring break there would be like in Malaysia or Australia. I mean, it was just a tremendous adventure. Very exciting. You know, we had a couple clients in Australia as well, so that worked out well. So I knew the country and that type of thing at that point. So I guess that would be the most surprising thing is that people know I lived in Thailand for a couple of years.
That is so cool, man. That's awesome. I'd love to do something like that. We got our kids are also tiny right now, maybe at some point, but
yeah.
That's amazing.
We had three at the time and they were from kindergarten to fifth grade. So pretty young and, you know, this is a very, very indelible experience for them. And they were the only all American kids there. I mean, they're only, heck, for that matter, the only white kids in their school. And you know, just talk about the, you know, complete shift from what, you know, Portland, Oregon to Asia and, you know, just being the only American kids there at their school. It was an international school, but their kid, you know, their classmates are from Singapore, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, China, India. I mean, just all over. So a really, really nice worldly experience for them at a very young age. And in Thailand, you know, it's been voted, you know, Bangkok's been voted, you know, it's either Florence or Bangkok. They kind of bounce back and forth. They're travel and leisure's, you know, best place to travel in the world. So yeah, I couldn't have asked for it.
The kids, like, was the school feel like more advanced than it was in Portland, or what was
I hate to even say it. I mean, it was so much better. So much better. Yeah. The probably the biggest thing was the expectations were higher. And so they gave out awards. They called them Super Achiever Awards on a monthly basis. So if you did the best in that class that month, you got a little, you know, a little certificate. And they had the online programming for kids. They had these, you know, they would compete against other schools and, you know, and it was amazing. I mean, they had, you know, and they had classes after school, and it was all included in the fee that we paid. And it was no more than our Catholic education that we had in Portland, Oregon for the kids, same price. And, you know, they had after school activities, like, you know, they had music class, they could have drama class, they could have science labs, they could play sports with no extra fees. Yeah, it was amazing, you know, and that concerned me. Funny thing. So a lot of my older son's friends were Indian. And so I went to go pick up my son at his friend's house one day, and I met the dad and what have you. We sat down for a moment and talked. And he says, you know, finals are coming up. He's like, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing about finals? I was like, yeah, my son's doing pretty well in school, that type of thing. And this Indian gentleman says to me, he's like, I'm taking off the whole week. I'm like, what do you mean? He said, I'm taking off the whole week to help prepare my son for the finals. And he's in fourth grade. This kid's in fourth grade having finals in fourth grade. And this Indian dad is saying, I'm going to take the week off to make sure that my son is ready for the examinations in fourth grade.
Wow.
I don't know about you, but I've never done that.
No. I barely studied myself.
Exactly. I can't imagine. Exactly. Maybe we shouldn't put this part up on the podcast.
Oh man. Well, this has been awesome, Mike. Thank you so much. Anything else on your mind you would maybe share with funeral service in general, or?
Well, yeah, no, I guess, you know, I'm in a unique position now that I'm in seniors housing. Again, serving the same clientele, you might say, serving elders and serving their families, and, you know, trying to serve them in the best way possible. You know, what funeral service does day in and day out is it's irreplaceable. You cannot substitute that with, you know, non-personal contact. You still got to have the personal contact, and it could be as simply something just like this. I mean, seeing you on video, having this conversation with you is fantastic. And so, I make a suggestion is use technology as much as possible, but keep the connections, keep that front and center. That's what you're there for. Start with a text, start with an email, start with a phone call, you know, move into video if you have to, if you don't have that ability to see them face to face, but keep the personal connection. And that's really going to allow the success of funeral service to continue on and do the things that they've done so well for so many generations. And, yeah, I'm just proud to say that I was in the funeral industry and proud to say that I'm still in the senior industry and happy to do what I can to help.
Awesome. Amen, man. That's a great wrap up. Well, thanks again, Mike.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Curtis. Nice to see you. I'll probably try to join you one of these days. Let me know when you want to come.
Yeah, will do.
All right, Curtis. Have a great day.